Let's begin. Obviously, we have Dr. Rostowski in mind, Chaim Erev and Moshe. We have the opportunity tonight to learn about the Levush. The Levush, his name was Rav Mordechai Yaffe. And he was, as much as his legacy is not well known because of sort of what he wrote and how the book he wrote was treated later on, I don't mean in any bad way, just in terms of it not, you know, becoming more popular. So we don't necessarily know who he was, but he was a very instrumental piece to a very, very important body of governance called the Vad Arba Aratzos. People are familiar with the Council of Four Lands. We've mentioned them in the past. He was the head of it at its outset. He was a very important piece of that governing body. And we'll talk about that as we go. But just to point out, we're speaking tonight about a Gadol Hador, even if people don't really understand or really know the name as well. His name was the Rav Mordechai Yaffe, the Levush. He was born in 1530 in Prague. Yes, that Prague of the Maharal, which he was very close with, the other Rabbanim, including Maharal. But this is before any of the High Aviva. We are, we're talking about Rav Mordechai Yaffe, the Levush, or the Baal HaLevushim, as some call him. But in 1530, he was born to Rav Avraham. Rav Avraham, his father, is an interesting, I couldn't really figure out. This Rav Avraham, his father, might have been his grandfather, was a very wealthy and well-off businessman who ultimately became a very important banker. In according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, he the Rav Avraham. I have a feeling it was his grandfather, not his father, just because this Rav Avraham passed away in 1533, which would have been 3 years after he was born. And I'm not familiar with that story. Either way, Jewish Encyclopedia says that he became the sort of financial intermediary and then the banker of the king of Hungary and Bohemia. Whose name was Ladislas. I have no idea if I'm saying that properly or not. Ladislas II. And then ultimately came to Poland and at sort of the suggestion of the other nobility, he became the banker for the Polish king, Alexander Jagiellonski and Sigismund. Again, not really 100% sure if that's how you say any of those words. But the point is, his father, maybe grandfather, Reb Avraham, who was also the chief rabbi of Bohemia, which is roughly, a big part of the Czech Republic today. So he was a banker for the Jewish people. Unfortunately, it seems like he wasn't appreciated by the Jewish people because what does it mean to be the banker? The intermediary between the governing power and the Jews? It means you're collecting the Jewish people's money. And for better or for worse, that in one case protects the Jewish people, right? The Jewish people do what they're supposed to do, so then, the ruling power will be okay with them, will protect them. But at the same time, you're asking Jews for their money. And then there was this whole other issue that I saw. This is Reb Avraham, either the father or the grandfather of the Levush, that I saw there was some kind of stipend that was supposed to be paid by the Jews to the intermediary. This was supposed to be some kind of, I saw one place it was the equivalent of a few hundred dollars. It wasn't a lot of money, but they just weren't paying it to him. And the governing body forced the Jews to pay it as if to say, like, he's the one that's protecting you. You should appreciate him. Either way, this position was called the Shtadlan or the Shtadlan, depending who you ask. It sounds almost like a precursor to the Vad Arba Aratzos. I mean, this was one person in charge of taking care of the sort of the financial intermediary of the Jewish people to the ruling power. That's what later on the Vad Arba Aratzos did. And they had sort of like a structure to do it, but it wasn't just one person. Either way, so this was his father, maybe grandfather, Reb Avraham Yaffe, who was also, again, the chief rabbi of Bohemia. So when Reb Mordechai was born, Reb Mordechai would learn from his father. And after a few years, as is often the case with these legends and lessons classes, Reb Mordechai showed his promise in becoming a rabbinic scholar already from a young age. And then his father, Rav Avram, decided that, I saw different versions of this. Either the family moved back to Poland, as I said before, he became the banker for the Polish king, or he wanted Rav Mordechai to get a better education, so he moved to Poland. Who was in Poland at the time? None other than the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, which is where he started. That was, I believe, in Lublin, which was the major city, which ultimately became sort of the headquarters of the Vada Abarasis later on. And then after that, he went to learn by none other than the Maharshal's cousin, also known as the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles. They were related, I believe. And the Rama, as we know, is, you know, the Rama. You know, he wrote the editions, or what we call, what's literally called the Mapa, even though everyone just calls it the Rama, which was the editions, the Ashkenazic gloss, if you will, over the Shulchan Aruch, which was written by Rav Yosef Kayo. Interestingly enough, while the Rama was Rav Mordechai Yaffa's teacher, he was only about 5 years older, according to their birth dates, assuming we've got their birth dates right, which is always itself a question. But he's only 5 years older. And later on, you know, 5 years when one of them is 25 and the other one's 20, kind of makes sense that, you know, one could teach the other. But once you get to like 45, 40, 50, 45, it's like, okay, we're contemporaries, you know? So that's ultimately what happens. We'll see how that happens later on. But he showed great proficiency, and after he had learned with the Maharshal, he learned by the Rama. He also learned Kabbalah, and ultimately, I'm not sure if he learned now or later. We'll see later why he learns other things, but philosophy, astronomy, and math. I saw in one source that it was at the behest of the Rama that he learned all of those things. I couldn't corroborate that at all. It would seem like that's not true, especially because it seems like he learned it later on for a specific reason we'll get to soon. But either way, I saw from one source that the Rama is who encouraged him to learn all this other stuff, the philosophy, astronomy, and math. And the Kabbalah could have also been from the Rama, although the Rama is not known as a Kabbalist. He was certainly aware of it, especially after his, you know, well-versed in Rav Yosef Kayo's works. But but he learned Kabbalah by, I'm trying to remember his name, Rav Matisyahu Della Kant. I forgot his name. I have it here. I can't read my handwriting. But sorry about that. But when he's 23 years old, so he gets married, and he moves back. He moves back to Prague, back to where he grew up, or at least where he was raised, where he was learning. But he goes back to Prague, and at 23 years old, he's married, and he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva in Prague. And already here, there is like a, seems like a common theme that comes up. This is a time of, you know, I don't know how to say this. Educational deviance is too strong a word, but educational alternatives, not in terms of like in the Enlightenment. That's much later. We're talking early 16th century, mid 16th century. Here we're talking about, you know, the development of what's called pilpul. Pilpul is, you know, almost second nature today. Pilpul is like, it's the analysis of the Rishonim and how they understand the Gemara. It's sort of comparing, contrasting different Gemaras and understanding sort of the underlying theory behind what the Gemara is saying. I mean, it's stuff that we do on Wednesday night all the time. That's pilpul. This is in somewhat contrast to sort of the traditional learning, at least at the time, which was what's the Gemara saying and what's the halacha therefore? As opposed to understanding sort of the underpinnings of the theory behind the Gemara, behind sort of why does Rashi say it this way and why does Tosa say it that way, and trying to sort of break down their philosophies. This was basically saying, what is the Gemara trying to say, and how do we paskin? It was much more like a linear way of learning. So Rav Mordechai Yaffa was much more in favor of the linear learning. He, as we'll see, is a halachicist. Ultimately, he writes a halachic work, a monumental halachic work. But that's sort of like the halachicist way of thinking. He's not learning in order to, you know, devise very, you know, elaborate philosophies of Gemaras or philosophy or perspectives of each Rishon and understand them for Torah Lishma type of purpose, but rather halacha l'maisa. What is the Gemara trying to say, and what's the halacha because of it?
Clearly, he had to be looking at, in the 1500s, certainly couldn't just go from the Gemara and say, what's the halacha? He certainly had to
look for sure.
The Rambam and the Arbaturim.
100%. He was definitely looking at their opinions in order to dictate halacha. I'm not saying he wasn't looking at Rishonim. That's different than saying, trying to understand sort of the philosophy of the Rishonim. I'm trying to think of a good example of this, but when we talk about, so I'll give you an example. This might be a little more brisker. I don't know. The distinctions are somewhat fine, and I don't know a good way to explain it. But for instance, we have Shalach Manos, right? There's a famous machlokes about Shalach Manos. Is the purpose of Shalach Manos in order to create camaraderie, or is it in order for people to have their food for their suda? Now that sounds like, okay, what's the difference? Well, the difference is, let's say, you give your Shalach Manos anonymously. So you're not really creating camaraderie in that situation because no one knows who gave them the food. At the same time, they have their food for the Suda, right? So that's what I talk about in terms of theorizing what's the sort of the underlying tenet. That's more of a brisker chakira kind of thing. But I see pilpul and brisker, brisk kind of sort of related in that way. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's right. It's not as much a pursuit of halacha as much as it is just, it's an exercise in intellectualism, and it's sort of the scholarly part of a Gemara without the practical part, They're not committed to understanding the end of the line. They're not moving down a track, which we hopefully ends up in psak. Well, what's the halacha? They're just sort of exploring, right? It doesn't have like that same, specific pursuit. It's just sort of like thinking, philosophizing, that kind of thing. So yeah, exactly. It's an intellectual enterprise. So he didn't like that. Mordechai Yaffe didn't like that. To his credit is a weird way of saying it. To his credit, that wasn't really done yet. That wasn't a common. It was sort of the cutting edge kind of thing of the new yeshivas. That's how they were learning. But it wasn't really something which he was personally used to. It didn't seem like that's how he was raised. I'm not really an expert in these things, so I'm just speculating in some ways. But originally, his father brought him back to Prague to join the business, which is an interesting little tidbit, just because of later in life, Reb Mordechai Yaffe will be himself in charge of some business enterprises when he becomes the head of the Avada Arba Ratzos. But for the time being, he stays as a Rebbe, and he stays in Prague as the Rosh Yeshiva, despite the fact that the Talmidim wanted to learn differently. He stays there for 8 years. And in 1561, what had already happened in 1542 and will happen again later on, the Jewish people, believe it or not, were expelled from Prague. This was done by a man by the name of Ferdinand. Not that Ferdinand, but the grandson of that Ferdinand. Ferdinand II of Aragon, who, along with Queen Isabella? Yeah, had expelled the Jews from Spain in 1492. This was his grandson, Ferdinand I of wherever, who had taken over the Holy Roman Empire. The Hobbes?
I think they were all Habsburgs.
Habsburgs. I don't remember. It goes through a bunch of different, depending on who gets married and who. Yeah, they're all the same thing. But either way, so he was the grandson named after Ferdinand II. And in much the same way, he didn't like the Jews, just like Ferdinand II, or at least didn't care too much about them to keep them around. So he follows in his grandfather's footsteps, and he kicks the Jews out of Prague. And when that happens, so then Rav Mordechai Yaffe moves to Venice. And it's there that he meets up with Rav Avram Abuhav. I'm not 100% sure of the connection. I believe he's related to the Abuhav from Tzfat, but I don't know that for sure. There's some story that people say about him meeting with Rav Abuhav. There's also some kind of historical suspicions that it was a different Abuhav because the dates don't really match up and he would have been way older than him. I don't know. But the point is that there's a story about Rav Mordechai Yaffe joining the court, joining the basin of Rav Abuhav, and at some point, this is the story that they say, I saw it in a couple places, that Rav Abuhav kicked him out. He says, you can't be in the basin anymore. And Rav Yaffe said, like, what did I do? Like,
you don't speak Italian.
Okay, could be. I don't know if he did or not, but yeah, it could be. But Rav Yaffe apparently told him it's because when my son said a bracha, you didn't respond amen. That's the story. That's the story. And for a little bit, he was sort of exiled out of the court. And then only later on came back to Rabuov pleading to come back. And Rabuov gives him this whole story, I think actually connected to the expulsion of Jews from Spain, where there was a specific rabbi who was supposed to ingratiate himself to I don't know if it was Ferdinand himself or one of the other emperors of the time. And in the meantime, somebody else was going to talk to the king, and this rabbi went off to daven mincha for a second, and when the priest or whoever was, I think it was a priest, was going to give this, was giving a blessing to the king, to the emperor, whoever it was, he had given a blessing, and everybody else said amen, except for the rabbi who was davening mincha. This is the story. And apparently this rabbi was ultimately executed for that after the king got upset at him, you know, after this accusation. Whoever this was, I don't know who it was, who that rabbi was in Spain that was killed, and then the Jews were exiled or whatever. So then Rabbi Buhav said that... I can't tell you. I can't tell you. This is, you know, legends. I'm quoting legends here. I can't tell you. I don't have it on recorded video that it happened that way. But this is how they say the story. And Rabbi Buhav said to Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe that I had to exile you as a kapara for not saying amen, just like that rabbi. And now that you've been exiled, so you can come back. And on condition that you always teach people the importance of saying amen to brachas. That's what he said, and I don't know if he said maybe you have to tell that story every time when you go to a new place, something like that. Something along those lines, the importance of saying amen. You can find it online, you can find that story. Anyways, so he ultimately goes to Italy, and when he's with the Rebbe Abuhav, they actually have a sort of, specialty or something. It seems like they specifically learned together the halachos of astronomy. And Kiddush HaChodesh, this is when presumably either he wrote or he studied for his later commentary to the Rambam's Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh. And in there he makes a bunch of statements, I haven't read it myself, but I've seen them quoted, that that this is how you calculate the halachic day, it's based on this movement of the sun and that movement of the sun. It was apparently a machlokas, should you count the 12 hours from the from Hanetz until Tseis, or from Hanetz until Shkia, and somehow he proved that it's from Hanetz, from the time the first rays of the sun come up until the ball of the sun goes down. Okay, which is a little too complicated to get into right now, especially because I don't know what he's talking about. But that's my point is, he definitely learned astronomy at that point in life, which is why I don't necessarily think it was the Rama who sort of pushed him in that direction. Either way, that's what he learned along with Avram Abuhav, if that was the right Abuhav. And then after that, so then I believe Ferdinand died, you know, in 1564 or something like that. And it was much better for the Jews in Poland. So he goes back in 1572 at the age of 42. He goes back and becomes the chief rabbi of Grodno. Grodno, you might recognize Grodno. It became sort of a Jewish stronghold for you know, a few centuries. So Grodno, Poland, and he started a yeshiva there. But here also he runs into Pilpul antagonists. He doesn't want to do Pilpul, but apparently the big askanim of the community want to do Pilpul. I saw another version of the story, which is that there was another Rosh Yeshiva there named Hagon Rav Moshe. He was the brother of the Kliyakar, which means that his last name was Lunchitz. And apparently they didn't get along with each other. That's all I have from that source. But I would surmise that maybe they didn't get along because of the different methodologies that he wanted to do straight. You know, Gemara Rashi Tosfos Halacha, and they were, and he, this Gon Rav Moshe, wanted to do more Pilpul. And if anyone's familiar with the Olos Ephraim, Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz's work, so he was very much, you know, not Pilpul, and I have never seen his Gemara works, but his commentary on Chumash is very analytical. And very sort of connecting things and understanding the underpinnings of them, like we were saying before. I'm not sure. So then after he stays there for a while. He was, you know, even though they had a difference of opinion of how to approach learning, he stays there at least according to one chronology, I have it from 1572 to 1588, which would be 16 years, although I saw in another place that maybe he only got there in 1577 from Italy, so I don't know how long it was. But he was there for at least a decade, which, you know, kudos to you know, having a difference of opinion, but still being willing to work with these other people. He ultimately is invited to become the chief rabbi of none other than Lublin, which is a big honor to be the rabbi of Lublin. That came with a lot more notoriety. You don't become the rabbi of Lublin without notoriety already. But once you become the chief rabbi of Lublin, you're essentially one of the Gdolei Hador. At that time, and that moment in history, Lublin was, you know, the headquarters of Ashkenazic Jewry, or one of. And this is what ultimately allows him to be part of the very first Vad Shalosh Aratzos. Don't really ask me what the lands are, but it started as the Council of Three Lands. It ends up becoming the Council of Four Lands. Dave, do you have any expertise on what are the four lands? I know there are really areas, not countries, and they switched all the time based on who had power and stuff. But we're talking like Czechoslovakia. We're talking about Poland, probably Lithuania.
They all have obsolete names.
Right, exactly. Right. They were like, it was like an amorphous collection of land, which they just called four lands, but wasn't really. Maybe at one point it was four lands, but then sort of it changes power, and then the land swaps and all these other things. It just kept the name Vad Arba Aratzos, and it was basically headquartered in Lublin. And he was in Lublin at the time, and he became the sort of the spokesperson for the Vad Arba Aratzos. At the time, I think I read it was only 40 rabbis, Polish rabbis, that had made up the Vad Arba Aratzos. But it was a very important body, which would act as the go-between between the, what was it, the Habsburg Empire still?
I don't think in Poland there were Habsburgs.
No, I don't remember.
Certainly in Hungary.
Okay. Okay, so who?
I don't think the Polish.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kings were,
I would not be the one to ask.
Dealing with Slavs here.
Uh huh. Okay. Either way, the Vad Arba Aratzos was that go between to collect taxes and to but beyond the taxes, they also had a certain oversight over communal policy. And one of the main things, especially back then, one of the main things that was really a problem, and we've talked about this a few different times, Rav Yotam Lipman Heller, we talked about it by the Kliyakar, I think also, the abuse financially of rabbinic positions, positions being bought and sold through different wealthy people, or the rabbis themselves, that were buying the positions. So this was one of the things that the Vad, and specifically Rav Mordechai Yaffe, was very opposed to and tried to put a stop to. You can't control everything, but at least that was his conviction that we have to stop that. He ultimately leaves Lublin to become the Rav of Kremenets, and then he goes to Prague to take over
Yeah. That's when my grandfather was from.
Yeah? I don't know. He was there for a couple years. It wasn't a long stop for him.
My grandfather was from Kremenets. Okay. It's in the Western Ukraine.
Okay. I don't know why he ended up there. I really don't. I couldn't find any material as to why he would ever leave Lublin. The fact that he goes to Prague, okay, I get that. He's from there. The Maharal was there. He's taking over from the Maharal. That's a big position. I have no idea why he was in Kremenets. Maybe you could look into that. Either way. And then the Maharal, I don't know what happened here. I don't remember the story. I probably should. The Maharal had left Prague to go to Posen, more famous for Rabbi Akiva Eger, but then he decided to somehow come back to Prague, so then they swap. So Rav Mordechai Yaffe, who was in Kremenets, goes to Prague to take over from the Maharal, who went to Posen. The Maharal wants to come back to Prague, so then Rav Mordechai Yaffe goes to Posen. They kind of just swap positions. I really don't know. I couldn't find any material as to why that happens, but I'm sure I could find it from the Maharal's advantage.
The greatness of Kremenets.
I guess so. Short-lived. I don't know. Until your grandfather got there, of course. Oh, yeah? Isaac Stern, the violinist, not the one from Schindler's List.
Isaac Stern, the famous violinist, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Either way, so he ends up in Posen, and that's ultimately where he passes away. At the age of 82, we have a letter that he sent to the Vad where he talks about, you know, 2 days before he died, this is, you know, my letter to you from my frailty in my bed, something along those lines. And then 2 days later, he passed away.
The Vad Arba Aratzos.
Yeah.
Did it set halachic policies
I don't know about halacha as much as it was more policy, like how to run, you know, structure a community and things like that. I mean, some things probably bordered on halacha, like buying rabbinic positions. I'm sure there are halachas involved in that. I think there are some things about heter iska. I know Rabbi Mordechai Yaffa was opposed to people leveraging heter iska for whatever they wanted, basically, to collect interest. I'm not sure if that he dovetailed that into a Vada Arba Ratzos thing or not. I know that was a personal thing of his. I read that somewhere. But that would be halachic, even though it's probably more communal policy-based. Either way, Rav Mordechai Yaffa was known sort of for his strong will and his conviction, and he opposed the abuse of different Jewish positions. He said, to be a Rav, you need 7 qualities. I think I'm, you know, striking out on this one, but he says you need ahavas ha'emes. You have to love truth, you know, with no compromises. That's number one. Ahavas habrios, you have to love all people. Number 3 was shem tov, you have to have a good name, whatever that means. Chachma, wisdom, yira, fear of heaven, anava, humility, and number 7, perhaps the one that we know him best for, is sinas mamon, the hatred of money. For multiple reasons, the way he meant it was not because rabbis don't get paid, but he was from a wealthy family, remember, but rather because there was a lot of abuse going on in the Jewish communities to buying off rabbis and things like that. So that's probably what he meant when he said that. But he's most well known for what's called the Levush. Rav Mordechai Yaffa is known as the Levush. There is another story that I was speaking today. Actually, someone was calling me. They're giving a shiur next week about Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, and they were listening to my shiur online about him, which just scares me because, like, I don't want anyone to base anything off of what I say in these classes, but, you know, to the extent that I do some research, you know, I'm not making it up from nothing. So he called me up and asked me, because he wants to give a shiur on Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller's personal Purim, which we don't have to get into right now, but he told me that his grandmother is a direct descendant of Rav Mordechai Yaffa, a Ben Achor Ben. So he is, you know, save for his grandmother, a Ben Achor Ben from Rav Mordechai Yaffa. 12 generations, that's what he says. I can't tell you how he knows that, but whatever. So he told me this story, and he said it's not really confirmed, but it's brought down. And I heard from a different shiur, B'shem the Chafetz Chaim. I think I'm pretty sure the person quoted the Chafetz Chaim as having written this story down somewhere. The story goes like this. Rav Mordechai Yaffa, Kishmo Kein Hu, as they say, his last name Yaffa means beautiful. Rav Mordechai Yaffa was apparently a beautiful person. This is what they say. Don't ask me any kashas. As they say, don't ask kashas on a maisa. The story is that he was beautiful. And much like Yosef HaTzadik, with beauty comes a lot of risk. That there are people that want to, you know, be with you. And there was this one woman that apparently on some kind of, I don't know if it was a business trip or whatever, was trying to seduce him. And he was trying to figure out how he was going to get out of the room. And he couldn't find any way to do it. The only brera that he had, the only thing that he could do was he saw there was an opening into a cesspool. This is the story goes. And he's wearing a bunch of clothing, a bunch of night clothing. And instead of giving in to the moment, he jumps into the cesspool and he gets all his clothes filthy, dirty, and he has to throw them all out. But this, they say, is why he was zocheh to write a book called The Levush. Because the Levush is made up of 10 different parts. It's actually named in his introduction. He doesn't say this. He has an introduction to the Levush. Levush Malchus, I think, is what he calls it. Ultimately, like the overarching book is called Levush Malchus. Or at least maybe the first 5 books are called Levush Malchus. There's a distinction between the first 5 and the last 5. But, and each one of them, it's actually based on the Megillah. The Megillah where it says that Mordechai comes out Levush Malchus, Techeles V'chor, all these different materials that are made up. So each one of his books is called one of those materials. He has Levush Techeles, he has Levush Ora, he has all these different books. And so he never mentions the story, but they say that because of this story, he was zochet to have all these Levush. The story continues, and there's a years later, there is a man who comes to a Rebbe with his son, and the man is very ugly, and the son is very beautiful. And they say, like, what gives? Like, are you this? How could the apple fall so far from the tree, basically? This is what the story goes. This is only 100 years ago or so, from what I recall. And the man says, the Lavush, after this story, because it was all caused by his beauty, after the story, he said, he davened to Hashem that for the next 10 generations, his children should all be ugly. This is how the story goes. I'm not making this up. I swear that my children should all be ugly. So the man says, I'm the 10th generation, and my son is the 11th. That's what they say. That's why I'm ugly, and my son is beautiful. Okay, as we've said before, I don't know if it's true, but they don't say stories about, like that about you or me. But that is why he's zochet to write the Lavush, according to legend. What?
I said, let's hope they don't.
That one, yeah. No, not that one. But let's go into what he says, right? The Lavush's words, why he writes the Lavush. And this is fascinating. I find this, I was speaking, sort of toot my own horn a little bit here. Someone reached out to me from Mosaica Press, which is a publishing company. And they said they were listening to some of my shiurim, and they wanted to meet about them. So we had a Zoom this morning, and they asked, you know, we've been listening to your Legends and Lessons classes. We'd love if you would write them up and publish them in a book. Wow. So first of all, it's a business. So like, I'm flattered, but at the same time, you're just trying to make money. But they asked me about the class and what do I do and whatever. And so I told them about this. I told them about tonight's class, and now I'm talking about the Lavush. And that the Lavush, exactly what I'm about to talk about, was in some ways not a litmus test, but like a harbinger of what's going to happen in Jewish history. Because what happens at this moment, for those familiar with the 16th century, this is, if you will, the sort of the golden age of halacha. Because while there was a Rambam, and there was a Rush, and there was a Rif, now is the age of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. And the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Cairo, was written, those were all written during the Lavush's lifetime. So the Lavush himself goes through a development, or goes through like a progression of desires. Even in the introduction to the book, in the introduction to the Lavush Malchus, it's a long introduction, not a long, relatively it's not so long, but it's you know, wordy. And he talks about how originally he wanted to, in the sort of the, you know, in the tradition of any great rabbi, to give over his own Torahs, to sort of let people know what his two cents about halacha and whatever. And then while he was, I think he says, while he was first in Venice, he had the idea of, this would be in 1561, when he got to Venice, he had the idea of creating the Shulchan Aruch. Now, he didn't call it that, but creating a halachic book, which would be a sort of a culmination, as opposed to the Torah, which was very elaborate, but sort of too much prose, too much analysis, too much, you know, compilation, not enough like succinct, what's the halacha. So says Lavush, I'm going to write a more succinct book, which will tell people the halacha without so much of the background information. So that sounds a lot like the Shulchan Aruch. And when he gets to Venice, he notices, someone tells him, by the way, Beis Yosef already beat you to it, right? Rav Yosef Cairo writes the Beis Yosef. I've seen different versions, I think. So one of some of Beis Yosef, someone says it was the Shulchan Aruch itself, basically said like, okay, you know, and it was already written. Beat me to the punch. Speaking of sort of publishing things before somebody else, right? Beat me to the punch. And then he says, okay, so I'm going to back out of my writing, my manuscript or whatever. So this is what he says in I'm trying to see, I printed this out because I think it has some of the, yeah. Vayhi bevo ha-sefer b'rishona ba'aratos ha'elu simchu alav kol lom de Torah ki chashvu l'kitzur k'neged ribo yasvarim. Right, this is, he's talking about the Shulchan Aruch. When the Shulchan Aruch came out, everyone was jumping for joy. Finally, we have a book that can just tell us what's the halacha. Rabbi, what's the halacha? Right, don't give me all the song and dance of the entire Maharsha and all the, you know, the Ran and the Rif and the Ram. Like, just give, you know, the Ram could have talked to use, but okay, we're going to leave the Ram for a second. But everyone was so happy about this.
Ram just says what it is.
Yeah, the Ram is pretty straightforward too. It didn't take in Ashkenazic. We know that there were controversies with the Ram also, but that was 300 years ago. So I don't know why the Ram didn't take to the same extent. But either way, so everyone was very, very happy about it. Kira Uhu, when he saw Mashbir Baral Chol Ami Haaretz, or sorry, when he saw that it was sort of proliferated all over, Vayinasu Al Kol Asfarim and Haposk Maharishom Asher HaYubayadenu, and it far over, superseded all of the other Rishonim Poskim, the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rash, far superseded all of their books. Q Kol Das Kulam, because it included all of them. Right, that's what Rav Yosef Karo says in the introduction. I think the Beis Yosef, maybe El Shulchan Aruch, that he's using the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush to determine what's going to go in the Shulchan Aruch. Right, so it's like a Cliff Notes. What do I need, to look at the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush for if I could just look at the Shulchan Aruch? V'gam Anochi HaKatan. This is what he's saying, and me too. Ba'anius Dati V'rach B'shanim. In my young age, at that time, if this was in Venice, he was in his low 30s. He says, "Rav Shana Az Haya Beinai Kemotzei Shel Arav." I thought it was unbelievable. Ach Barov Hayamim Raisi V'Isponanti Ki Adayin Darko Hu Derech Arucha Maod. Even the Shulchan Aruch was hold on. Oh, I think this is talking. This might be talking about the Torah first. The Torah is the compilation, is the summary, and then he said, "Okay, well, I'll make a more concise summary." So then, so he says, Kizal Kihuzal Rochev Hispashtus Sichlo Harav La'ayin Bo B'Nikle Karuhu Ktara, because of how he thinks this. I think this is a compliment. The Torah, in his sort of vast knowledge, thought this was sort of shorthand, but really it was still too much. Az Amarti Elech Li Beikvav Ve'Rishom Li Kitra Adinim. I'm going to write a shorter one. Al Pias Kama Socha Kasev Li Sha'en Al Shlosha Amudei Hara. Just like the Rambam from the Rush, he used. I'll use the Rambam from the Rush also. About Aspirei Mitameyam Uvidarkam Kitra Shev Shar. But I'm going to do it in a more concise manner, as opposed to the Torah, which is much more explanatory. That I started to do. This is what he's saying in the introduction. And then, in the meantime, when he goes to Italy, then he goes to Italy. I guess he was still in Prague at that time. Then he goes to Italy. V'sham matza ki Rav Yosef Kairo chiber es ha-shulchan aruch shu kitra tor v'habes Yosef. That the Rav Yosef Kairo wrote already a more concise version of the Torah in this shulchan aruch. Ach gam ze, so sorry. Yosef Kitzar yado. Meod, and that was very short. V'loyas biklal l'mayinimo, ki hu k'sefer achasum u'chichalum kolopitarum. U'chilu hayakol halachal mosh misinai b'lo shum tam. The problem with Shulchan Aruch, in the eyes of the Levush, was Shulchan Aruch just says, this is what to do. And doesn't give any sources. Doesn't explain even, this is according to so-and-so, this is according to so-and-so. Just straight halacha, bottom line. So he thought that wasn't good enough either. And besides that, Lichtov Levaris Hatzinim Hanogim Be'elar to Ashkenaz, PM Maharin Poland Russia Agfin. I don't know what that place is. He's listing different places. I must be pronouncing that wrong. Aleph Gimel Pe Yud He Nun Agpihan Agpan. I don't know. I must be saying it wrong. But either way, so he says, but Shulchan Aruch, short, doesn't explain it, and it also doesn't give the reason, the psak of the Ashkenazim. So he figures, okay, I'll start writing the Ashkenazim one. Achazer Mashach Yado, this is the article saying. And then he says, Ki rechokim v'kvom darkehem midarchi machshosim machshosai kiem kas v'divrein below tamim v'inei heim archu sholchanam b'chol minim adanam migadim v'kafarim im niradim. Hold on. He says how you wonderful foods, but without any salt. So without any salt, you can't taste it. Meaning, you don't give the explanations for any of these things. Meaning, even with the Rama, he says the Rama is also too concise. He's not explaining anything. So then he ultimately decides that he's going to write the Levush, which is itself what he already talked about was included in the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah, but just not in the right proportions. It's almost like a Goldilocks. We had the Torah, which was like way too much, too wordy. And then it was cut down to the Shulchan Aruch, not wordy enough. And he's like, I'm going to write the Goldilocks. I'm going to write the perfect mix of not all the information, but enough where you can sink your teeth in, understand a little of the background, which to me, honestly, it reminds me of the Aruch HaShulchan, which doesn't come out for another 400 years or 300 years. But the point is that he wanted to find a good middle ground. So what I have, that's essentially what he did. And for better and for worse, he did that effectively. And in his lifetime, it was learned, and it was actually published multiple times, even while he was alive, at least the first five. The first five were our halachic works, which are basically commentaries, like the Shulchan Aruch, on Orach Chaim, and Yoredeya, and Choshen Mishpat, and Evan Ezer. Each one of them has a different name. Actually, I might have a list up here. Hold on. Levush Tcheles. Levush Tcheles is on Orach Chaim, which is the first chalak, which the Mishnah Berurah did. Levush Hachor, which is specifically Shabbos and Yontif. But the first Levush HaTcheles is just the Yimei HaChol, the weekday stuff. And the Levush Ateres Zahav is Yoredeya. Levush Habutz V'Har Gaman is I think that's supposed to be Evan HaEzer. Levush Ir Shushan is Dine Choshen Mishpat. And then after those first five, those are the halachic ones, then he has different. These are sort of like all over the place, sort of like a potpourri. He has a Levush Ha'ora, which is actually accessible on Safaria for those who want it, which is a commentary on Rashi and Rav Eliel Mizrahi. It's a super commentary on a super commentary, which is pretty fascinating. So you can see his range in terms of his halachic.
So it's a commentary on Rashi.
Rashi and Rav Mizrahi, which is a commentary on Rashi.
On Rashi and the
Chumash.
Yeah. Okay, so this.
Completely different book.
From being a, okay.
Yeah, completely different. That's why I said the first five and the second five are completely different. Levush Ha'ora, which is a commentary, super commentary, and super, super commentary on Chumash and Rashi. And then Levush Simcha V'Sason is his drashos for Yontif. I couldn't find them because, whatever, Otzar HaChachma is not working for me right now. Levush Pinas Yikras, which is his explanations of Tosfos, and the Mor Nevuchim. It's got both in there. It's all over the place. Mor Nevuchim is a philosophical work from the Rambam. Then Levush Eder Hayakar. I don't think he's in the Psukim of, maybe he is, maybe I don't remember the Psukim of the Megillah anymore. But that's a parish on Kiddush HaChodesh, which is what I talked to you about, that he was learning with Rav Avram Abulav. And then lastly, the last Levush is Levush Evan Hayikara, which is a parish on the Rikanti. Dave, you know the Rikanti? It's Kabbalistic. It's it's a Kabbalistic work, which again shows you his range. It might be. I don't remember. So either way, so the Levush. Those are all 10, and it's just unbelievable all the things that he could write about. You know, with all of his background, all of his expertise. The one thing he didn't write is a book of Pilpul. You know, ironically, it's the one that was probably most popular of the day, especially in Prague. You know, we're talking about, you know, the Maharshal. Ultimately, the Maharshal. You know, that those were, you know. He doesn't have any Shalos Teshuvas, and he doesn't have any Pilpul, which is probably the most prominent books that were coming out those days. He wrote on everything else. He wrote on Rashi and Chumash, and he wrote on Kabbalah, and he wrote on Halacha. He wrote on the Mor Nevuchim, and he wrote, you know, just the unbelievable kind of range that he could write all of this. Unfortunately for him, at least the first five were obviously the most instrumental in terms of what were being read immediately. You know, not everybody wants to pick up a commentary on the Rikanti or a commentary on the Mor Nevuchim, but everybody wants a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So this is basically, it's not a commentary, but it's his own version of the Shulchan Aruch. And I don't think it follows the pagination of the Torah or anything like that. I don't think. I think it has its own codification. Either way, it was very popular when it came out. Again, he was the Gadol Hador. You know, Mordechai Yaffe, the head of the Avada Arbaras, was coming out with a halacha sefer, you're going to go buy it. You know, that's like Rav Moshe Feinstein coming out with Igros Moshe. Everyone's going to go get the Igros Moshe. So it was very popular while he was alive. Since then, we'll be frank here, oftentimes we will talk about these Rabbanim and talk about how their Torah is learned all the time and whatever. This Levush is not read at all.
There was a shiur in Detroit,
yeah,
in Elk Park,
okay,
about 30 years ago on the Levush.
Oh yeah, straight Levush.
From Rabbi Eliezer
Cohen. Yeah? He
said it's a fine work.
It is.
It's overlooked.
It is.
His timing was off.
Right.
It's Shiur on Saturday, Shabbos afternoon.
Yeah.
And so, for a few weeks, it wasn't long term.
Right. So you're saying he just focused on it for a little bit.
He also did Sifra for a couple of weeks. He said, why are you only learning Sifra?
Right. I mean, Medrash in general. Yeah.
Medrash Halacha.
Right, Medrash Halacha, yeah. But either way, so very nice tidbit about Rabbi Cohen. I don't know if Aviva, you knew that. But. So
something that happened 30 years.
Yeah, I think so. Well, Shalosh Shuvos was between Mincha and Ma'ariv. I think it was before Mincha.
It was like the Shabbos afternoon shir. Very nice. So, but ultimately, you know, his Goldilocks approach is what did him in. Because ultimately what happens is the Talmid HaChachamim, right, the ones who want to really learn in depth, they'll learn the Rishonim, and then they'll look at the Beis Yosef. They'll learn the whole thing, you know, the whole, you know, kit and caboodle, as they say. And if you're a Baal HaBas that doesn't have the same background or time or energy to learn, so you're going to use the Shulchan Aruch. So who's learning the Levush? Right? It's sort of like in between, and therefore gets lost in the shuffle. There was a new printing, you know, 5-10 years ago, a nice, big, beautiful printing. Nowadays, everything's being reprinted. But I can... The one thing that's quoted, the Levush is quoted a lot in Tshuva Sfarim. You know, a lot of the quotations, because he has Chidushim. He suggests things that other poskim don't suggest, but he's just as formidable of an opinion. It's just that the book itself is not one of those books you have on your shelf that you reference all the time, because you got the Shulchan Aruch to reference, or the Beis Yosef, so it just gets lost in the shuffle. So this colleague of mine that was telling me he's a 12th generation descendant of the Levush told me that one time he asked a Shaila of Rav Mordechai Willig, and he went to his bookshelf, picked up a Levush, and answered a Shaila from the Levush. But that's the only time he's ever seen someone, you know, learn straight from the Levush. Anyways, so I figured, you know, a good way to sort of finish off the shir and understand the Levush is maybe to go into, first of all, a halacha from the Shulchan Aruch, but also how the Levush, similarly or dissimilarly, you know, gives over the same halacha, okay? Again, his whole intent was to do exactly what the Ramah did. He wanted to give an Ashkenazic gloss to the Shulchan Aruch, but with a little more, you know, expose, if you want. So in the Shulchan Aruch, sort of the most famous halacha, unfortunately, of Purim, is Chayiv Inish Lebesum B'Pera Adelo Yada Beit Araham LeBaruch Mordechai. It happens to be, which is, you know, a person should get drunk on Purim to the extent that they don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. Happens to be that the Ramah commentary on this Shulchan Aruch is very long. Relatively, this is a long one. But the Ramah says, Yesh om de'ein sarach lishtaka kolkach, el yishte yosr milimudo, you know, the Ramah that nobody passes like, magically nobody passes like the Ramah when it comes to Purim. But the Ramah says, you really shouldn't get drunk. You should have a little more than you're used to. And then, Yashin, you should go to sleep. Umitoch sheyashin, en yodea, bein araham achmordechai. This is not the Ramah's own chesh, this is from the Maharil, a late Rishon, who many of the psak of the Maharil is found in the Ramah. And then he says, ve'achra maru ve'achra mabit, and whether you drink a lot or you drink a little, uvilvad sheyachavin libel shemayim, as long as you have the right intentions when you're doing it, that makes it okay. So this is the Levush's commentary on the same halach, okay? He says, first, tzarech lihishtaker ad lo yada bein arur hamal lebaruch Mordechai. So he doesn't quote the Gemara in the same language, which is interesting. You know, sometimes if you're writing a book for the masses, you would assume that you would write it in the vernacular that people can understand easier. Chayiv inish lebesume bepuraya is kind of an interesting phrase. You know, it's Aramaic, and unless you know what it means, you don't know what it means. So when he says it in his, so he says it in Hebrew. And then he says, Arur Zeresh Brucha Esther Arurim Kol Harishan Bruchim Kol Yehudim, which I don't believe is in the Gemara, but he quotes the rest of the whole song. Why? Because if you're that drunk, presumably you're happy. Which is an interesting line. Obviously, that kind of sounds silly, but his point is that. The goal is not to not know the difference between Baruch Han and Baruch Han. It's in order to be happy, and that's a barometer of how happy you are. Are you happy enough? Are you that drunk? So that's what he's saying. And Vada Husameach. At that point, you can rest assured that you're happy. V'yesh Omrim She'ein Sarach Liyishtaker Kolkach. Why? He doesn't say. The Ramah never said why. He says, some people say you shouldn't get so drunk. Shehar be'michsholos yavo al yidei shikras. Many failures come because of drunkenness. Shugorem legilu arayos ushvichus damim. It can cause illicit relationships, and it can cause murder, which is maybe literally, but it also may be just a reference to the Gemara Megillah, which says that Reb Zera killed somebody, whatever. The kama averos ulasan, and besides all the other averos that you might commit while you're drunk. Lefikach, therefore, lo yishta elamat. Rather, you should not drink except for a little bit. Yoser milimudo, a little more than you're used to. V'yashen, umitoch sheyishen, lo yeda ben arahamon mechule. V'yachramar v'yachramah melebal shechayv libo shamayim. And then he basically just says the rest of the Rama. And then he says, I don't know if this is in the Rama. This next part is not in the Rama. Oh, no, he does. It does later on. It's a different order. But he says also that if you're going to drink or you're going to have a suda, you should make sure to learn first because the pasuk is like, Yehudim ha'itza ora v'simcha. Ora, which is Torah, comes before simcha, which is the drinking. So make sure to do that first. So you see in that, just sort of a small microcosm of the fact that the Rama had it sort of like a little more shorthand, and the Levush brings the same concept from the same sources, but just explains it a little bit more. Not so much more like the Torah, but a little bit more. So that's his sort of like, and you can see that throughout. I just wanted to give you one example of where he does that. But if you look at the Rama, I mean, this is, I mean, it's hard to see from here, but this is Shulchan Aruch, you know, this is Beis, this is Gimel, this is Dalet. You see just short lines. And then down here is the Levush, like much longer paragraphs to explain the same things. So that's the Levush, that's Rav Mordechai Yaffe. You know, it's sort of underrated the fact that he moved around so much during his life. And we talked about he was in like probably 10 different cities as a student and as Rav. And he was expelled, you know, pushed out of Poland, come back to Prague, whatever. And he was able to accomplish such unbelievable feats, not only in terms of, you know, this monumental work, the Levush Malchus, which is, you know, pages and pages and pages, volumes upon volumes, but also in his own life, rising to the level of notoriety where he could basically lead Ashkenazic Jewry as the head of the Vat Arba Ratzos and instill policy to make sure the Jewish people are functioning, you know, in a way that they have to, whether it's with the government or internally. And in that way, it's kind of interesting, as I started, his father/grandfather, Rav Avram Yaffe, was also someone who was sort of taking care of the Jewish community. It wasn't yet called the Vat Arba Ratzos, but he was the chief rabbi of Bohemia, and he was also the banker as a go-between in Poland after being the same thing in Hungary and in Bohemia. So like he follows his father's sort of path with a lot more notoriety and a lot more literature to sort of connected to his name. So either way, that's Rav Mordechai Yaffe in a nutshell. His yahrzeit is tomorrow night, the 3rd of Adar Sheni specifically. And Meretz Hashem, his neshama shalom aliyah, we should be inspired by all of the sacrifices made for the Jewish people. And now, whenever anyone quotes the Levush, you'll know a little bit about him to understand his history a little bit more. Okay, everyone should have a good night.